preached in Ohio for him, and one of these men in his church took me squirrel hunting. And I said, how are we going to go squirrel hunting? We don't even have guns. And he said, we don't need guns. I said, what do you mean? He said, you come with me. And we went out, and this guy got underneath a tree, and there was a squirrel up there, and he went, that squirrel fell right out. I said, what did you do? He said, I uglied it to death. And he did two or three that way. And I said, man, this is tremendous. I have never seen this done. Anyone else do that? Oh, he said, I took the preacher with me, but he tore him up too bad. So that's, of course, not true. But it was a good thing to be able to be here with you tonight. In Acts chapter 7, I want to talk to you tonight about Moses, a lesson in trial. Acts chapter 7 and verse 20. In which time Moses was born, was exceeding fair, nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and in deeds. And when he was a full 40 years of old, it came to his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not. The next day he showed himself unto them as they strove and would have set them at one and saying, sirs, your brethren, why do you wrong one another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away and said, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Will you kill me as you did that Egyptian yesterday? And then fled Moses at this saying and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begat 2 sons. And when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. When Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight, and he drew near to behold it. The voice of the Lord came unto him, saying, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And then Moses trembled and did not behold. Then said the Lord to him, put off your shoes from your feet. For the place where you're standing is holy ground. I have seen, and I have seen the affliction of my people, which is in Egypt. And I have heard their groaning, and them come down to deliver them. And now, come, I'll send you into Egypt. This Moses whom they refused, saying, who made thee a ruler and a judge? The same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of an angel which appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren like unto me. Him shall ye hear. You remember the story. They were in bondage in Egypt. They had been there for many, many years, 215 to be exact, the 430 years or 400 years that was promised to Abraham that his seed would be persecuted for 400 years doesn't start at the time they went to Egypt, but starts with the weaning of Isaac when an Egyptian boy, born of an Egyptian girl, persecuted Isaac. And that began the 400 years that they were going to be persecuted. But the thing I want you to see here is that they're going to come out of Egypt. And Moses was born at this particular time. And you'll notice it says he was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And you remember the story, how that the girl found him there in the bulrushes and his own mother got to raise him. What happened since his own mother got to raise him is here's what she did. Moses, all the other little boy babies your age were killed, and you escaped. God's going to use you, Moses. You're the man. God's going to use you in a great way. God has let you escape for a reason. You are someone special, Moses, and God's going to use you, Moses. And I want you to know that the Bible says in the Hebrew passage that he was learned in all the ways of the Egyptians. That he preferred rather to suffer affliction with the people of God rather to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. And I want you to know that in the beginning, history says that Moses was a great general in the Egyptian army, and that he even led the armies of Egypt into battle. His life can be divided into three different areas. 40 years thinking he was somebody, 40 years as a nobody, and 40 years seeing what God could do with a nobody. But in the beginning, he was someone special. I want you to notice what it says in verse 22. That Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and in deeds. That's before God called him. That was the first 40 years. When he lived in Egypt, he was a man of mighty words and deeds, a great military leader. He refused to suffer affliction, or rather preferred to suffer affliction with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. He was raised with a silver spoon in his mouth, raised right in Pharaoh's own palace, and was a great talker and a great doer of deeds. History says that one time he surrounded a city in such a marvelous way that the princess of the city sent him out an ambassador and said, if you'll marry me, I'll surrender my city to you. He was a man of mighty deeds, a great talker. But instead of enjoying the pleasures of sin for a season, he preferred to suffer affliction with the people of God. And it says he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. What is he? Some kind of an unthankful wretch that he would refuse to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter? This girl who had spared his life? Why was he so rude to refuse to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter? Why didn't he want to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter? Well, it goes back to their worship. They worshiped the sun, S-U-N. And they thought Pharaoh was the sun in the flesh. That he was the sun incarnate. And they worshiped Pharaoh as God in the flesh, the sun in the flesh. And if he's the son of Pharaoh's daughter, that would make him the son of God. So he refused to be called the son of God. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused worship. He could have had wine and women and song and worship. And he preferred rather to suffer the affliction with the people of God. And he felt that God's hand was upon him. If you look in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 11, here's what it says. That he was called Moses, she said, because I drew him out of the water. And when it came in those days when Moses was grown, they went unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way. And when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and he hid him in the sand. He murdered him. It wasn't self-defense. He didn't have to kill him. He looked this way and that way. And then he slew him for harming one of the Israelite people. History says that what happened was is that he had molested a Jewish woman. And her husband had tried to defend her, and this Egyptian was fighting with her husband, and Moses slew the man for hurting his Israelite friend, and the next day when he sees a couple of Jewish boys fighting, I call them Jews, they weren't called Jews until the days of Nehemiah, but later on they became Jews, and so it's all right to call them Jews, just like we say President Lincoln, when he was a boy, went fishing in the Ombraw River. Well, he wasn't President Lincoln when he was a boy, he became president, so we say President Lincoln when he was a boy, and in that respect, I'm calling them Jews. And when he saw this Jewish fellow being killed by this Egyptian, or at least assaulted by this Egyptian, he murdered him. And then you remember that it says, now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. I mean, here is a Jewish fella killing an Egyptian, and Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So here's what I'm trying to get you to see. In the first 40 years, he thought he was somebody. And he was a great speaker and a great general, a doer of mighty words. The world was at his fingertips. Everything that men seek for, fame and fortune and wine and women and song, was his for the having. He could have been worshipped. And he thought that his brethren ought to have understood, verse 25 says in chapter 7, it plainly says he supposed that his brethren would have understood how that God, by his hand, would deliver them. But they understood not. Obviously, I'm the man. God raised me up. Mama told me so. God's going to use me to deliver. There's no evidence that God ever told him that. But he had a very high opinion of himself. And when you're a great talker, and you're a mighty doer of deeds, and you're raised with a silver spoon in the mouth, and you want to deliver your brethren, and you're raised in the palace, and you've had advantages that other people didn't have, it's easy to say, I'm the man. It's obvious that I'm the one that God is going to fulfill the promise to Father Abraham that after 400 years they'll come out with great substance. And that's probably what emboldened him to look this way and that way and slay the Egyptian. And so I want you to notice, first of all, he sought to do things his own way. And he failed. A miserable failure at 40 years of age. So what does the Bible say next? Well, here's what the Bible says next in Exodus chapter 3. It says, now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. That's the same as Sinai. The angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And you remember Moses, well, I'll turn aside, see what's going on. And God told him to take off his shoes. And God told him very plainly, I want you to come forth, he says in verse 10. Come now, therefore, I'll send you unto Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And Moses said unto God, who am I? I've heard that before, only had a different pronoun on the end of it. He heard 40 years ago, who are you? And now this confident orator and great general has been tending sheep for 40 years. And when God finally does call him, he says, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel? And the Lord said, I'll be with you. And he promises to help him. See how that worked on him? What people think about you can really affect how you behave. And Moses, when he had that attitude, I'm the man. I just can't understand why my brethren cannot understand why God, by my hand, is going to deliver Israel from Egypt. But now he's on the back side of the desert, in the desert of Midian. The Jews faced the east, so they called anything on the other side the back side. And I want to dwell on that for a moment. I like to call it Moses getting his BD degree. Backside of the desert. 40 years thinking he was somebody. And then 40 years as a nobody. He's on the backside of the desert, living with his father-in-law, with two snotty-nosed kids, on the backside of the desert, tending sheep for 40 years. Do you remember what Joseph said to his brothers when they came down to Egypt and they were reconciled? He said, "You tell them you're shepherds. For shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians." Instead of putting your best foot forward and trying to hide the fact that you're shepherds, because Joseph didn't want his brethren to intermarry with the Egyptians, he says, "You tell them you're shepherds, because shepherds are an abomination." And they got the land of Goshen, and they moved them away from the Egyptians because Joseph didn't want them to intermarry. The Egyptians hated shepherds because the Hyksos had whipped them in war, and they hated shepherds. And here is Moses tending sheep. It's as low as an Egyptian boy can get. When you see Moses tending sheep for 40 years, you're not seeing anything different than the Jews saw in the prodigal son when he was feeding pigs. Jews feeding pigs is not one bit different than an Egyptian feeding sheep. He was as low down as he could get. 40 years, he supposed that his brethren ought to have understood how that by his hand God was going to deliver Israel. But now, after 40 years in the desert, he's a nobody. He had led military campaigns, and now all he leads is sheep. He had addressed crowds, and now he only talked to sheep. For 40 years on the backside of a desert. See, the education of this world, he's learned in all the ways of the Egyptians, but the education of the world cannot prepare you to lead God's people. God's got to bring you to the backside of the desert. God's got to take you to a place where he can talk to you. And that's the meaning of the word desert. They're just a little bit different words. One is midbar and the other is dabar. One means to speak, to answer, to appoint, to bid, to command, to commune, and to subdue. And God's going to get him out there where he can talk to him, where he can get his attention, where he can make him realize, "You're not that hot. I'm not going to use you while you're a great speaker. I'm not going to use you as a great military leader. I'm going to bring you down to the place that you don't have such a high opinion of yourself. Because it's not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord." And when he's humbled, and God speaks to you, and you begin to see yourself as you really are, then he can use you. A husband, father, living with in-laws. I mean, how utterly hopeless for a man of his ability and his talents to be back in the desert for 40 years tending sheep. Where are you tonight? Are you where you thought you would be at your age? It's like a guy was talking to his boy and he said, "Son, when Abraham Lincoln was your age, he had read hundreds of books and was brilliant." And the boy said, "Daddy, when he was your age, he was president." But where are you? Where are you at your age? Did you think at one time that the world revolved around you? I can honestly say this. Other preachers have said it, but certainly true of me. I said it before I ever heard another preacher say it. When I was 18 years of age, about the time Brother Johnson first met me, I was 20. I honestly thought my name would be a household name. I thought I would convert the world. Finally, I settled down with just the United States. And I finally got it down to Indiana. And then I got it down to the town where I lived. And then I got it down to the church where I preached. And then I got it down to my family. And now I got it down to me, and I'm worried about me. Are you where you thought you'd be? You see, as long as you think and you suppose that you're the man, I'm the woman, I'm the one that I'm obviously the fellow, God can't use you. Not many rich, not many wise, not many noble. God delights in using the weak things of the world. If you ever read the book of Judges, you just want to go down there and go right through the book of Judges, and you want to notice he used the weakest of the weakest. He used women to destroy the enemy when the woman dropped the pottery over the wall. He used a woman like Deborah. He used a left-handed Ehud. He used Gideon of the smallest tribe or the weakest tribe. He just kept going over, and I can't get over that thing. You just can't imagine. That's what the book of Judges is about. That's not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. God delights in using the weak things, that men would glory in God instead of in men. And he had to reduce Moses, get him over the idea that I'm the man. So instead of people saying, "Who are you?" he'd say, "Who am I? How can I?" And that's where God wants us. He wants us not to do things our own way. He wants us to see that he prepares us to do it his way. The education of the world won't do it. God's got to put you on the backside of the desert. Let me ask you a question. You got a bad marriage? You got a job that you absolutely hate? You got a sick child you got to take care of? You got a broken home. You got to care for an aged parent. You got a broken romance. Are you so lonely you can just hardly stand it? You got a child gone bad. You got problems you didn't think you'd ever have. Has God led you to the backside of the desert so he can talk with you? So he can get your attention? That's where he wants you. He wants you to get a BD degree, a backside of the desert degree. I had a wife that was the most perfect human being I ever met. I'm telling you the truth. I never met anybody in my life that was as holy and righteous, and I used to lay in bed. Just a couple of years before the divorce, I used to lay in bed and think, how can somebody always have the right attitude about everything? And I had a car accident. And she hit her head in the car accident. And that was October 27th, 1975. And by January 1st, 1976, I was living with a totally different woman. This gentle person who was so easy to please, I couldn't do anything right. And so in 77, she filed for divorce. We went back together 14 months, and finally she went ahead and went through with the divorce. And I remember seeing her car at the lawyer's office, and she'd promised me she wouldn't do it, but there was her car, and I walked right on into the lawyer's office, and she said, I'm going to divorce you. And I remember going out and getting my car and driving my car, and I was stopped at a stoplight, and I was pounding the steering wheel with all of my might, hollering at the top of my lungs, "God, where are you?" They didn't answer. Me, divorced. Me that was going to win the world to Christ. See, I've been on the back side of the desert. But I'll tell you something. God puts you on the back side of the desert to help you. He allows it. He didn't make that happen, but he allowed it to happen. And I'm a better man for it. I thought about not preaching, and I thought, no, I was a preacher when I married her. Men are still lost. The gospel's still true. Jesus still saves. And if all that the devil has to do is to get a man out of the pulpit, is to get his wife to leave him, then if I was the devil, I'd just work on preachers' wives. And sometimes I think that's what he does. But that puts you, that'll humble you. Years after that, I was driving to marry a young woman in the church to her husband, her fiance, and I went, whoop. And I thought, oh man, I hit a deer. And I got out of my car and went running back to the deer, and it was a 30-year-old woman. And I'd hit her and killed her. And I remember standing there as plain as day saying, "Lord, you've let me kill this girl." That'll humble you. That can put you through some hard times, but I'm a better man for it. My wife and I lost babies in miscarriage. All of my kids but one. No, I got to take that back. All of my kids have lost babies by miscarriage. All five of my children's had miscarriages. My son Jeff's kid, little boy, Andrew, was born dead. You go through a lot, but that's to get your attention. I remember years ago, after I'd been divorced a few years, my boy, I bought him a three-wheeler, and one of the neighbor kids got on the three-wheeler and was going in between the house and the garage, and he hit it with the left wheel and tipped him over, and I went running over there and picked him up and said, "You all right? You all right? You all right?" And a big dent in the side of my garage. And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, get up and take off." And he got up and took off, and his girlfriend came over and put her arm around me, and she said, "Mr. Fall, if that had been my dad would have killed him for putting a dent in his garage. And all you were concerned about was him. I don't get it." And I laughed and I said, "There was a time in my life I'd have thrashed him. But since my divorce, I've learned something. Things don't happen. Don't matter. Things don't matter. People do." See, you go through things. He lets you get on the backside of the desert so he can speak to you. So he can subdue you. He can appoint you. He can command you. Let me prove this by scripture. Look what the Bible says in Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 10. Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 10. Listen to what that says. "He found him in a desert," speaking of the nation of Israel called Jacob. "He found him in a desert land, in a waste and a howling wilderness. He led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple or the pupil of his eye. And as an eagle stirs up her nest and flutters over her young and spreads abroad her wings and takes them and bears them on her wings, so the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. He made him to ride on the high places of the earth that he might eat the increase of the field. He made him to suck honey out of a rock and oil out of a flinty rock, butter of cattle, milk of sheep, fat of lambs, rams of the breed of Bashan, goats with the fat of the kidneys of wheat. You did drink the pure blood of the grape." See, found him in a wilderness. He created the nation of Israel in a wilderness. And look what it says he did. He encompasses us, chapter verse 10. He instructs, verse 10. He protects like the pupil of his eye. And he leads and he provides for, in verse 13. See, God doesn't lead you out in the wilderness and abandon you. You know that famous poem that's now famous about the boy that said there was two footprints in the sand, and then he noticed that there was only one footprint in the sand or one set of prints in the sand. He said, "Why did you leave me?" He said, "I didn't leave you. I was carrying you." God lets us go through hard times. But all this time, he's leading, he's instructing, he's teaching, he's protecting. I love this picture. As an eagle stirs up her nest and flutters over young spreads, certain eagles go up to its nest and the little eaglet jumps on its mother's back. And the eagle begins to soar, and then it shakes itself, and the little eaglet falls off of its back and begins to go, trying to fly. And mama comes under and picks it up and takes it up again and tries over and over and over to teach the little bird to fly. That's what God does. As an eagle stirs up her nest and flutters over her young and spreads abroad her wings and teaches them, or taketh them, bearing them on her wings. So the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. You know what God told Moses that one day on Mount Sinai? You're going to worship me on this mountain. And sure enough, he was given the Ten Commandments on that mountain. And he worshiped God on that mountain. He'd been tending sheep there for years. See, when God lets bad things happen to you, it's supposed to help you. But too many of us are like the children of Israel in the Old Testament. When they went through the wilderness, they murmured, they complained, they groused, they fussed, they feuded, they fought. They murmured. Have you ever noticed what terrible sins murmuring is mentioned with? Adultery and fornication and murder and lusting after evil things. Murmuring's a great sin. You see, the purpose of the desert is to sandblast you, to remove the dross, to refine you. It's not to destroy you. It was a building in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Ugliest thing you ever saw. I mean, it was ugly. And I thought, boy, that is an eyesore in this town. And one day I was downtown, and there was great big trucks in there with sandblasters. And it was a yellowish building. And they sandblasted that building, and it was no longer dirty, ugly yellow. They sandblasted that building, and the building was golden. And it ended up being one of the most beautiful buildings in the city of Fort Wayne. Because when it was sandblasted, and all of that mold and all of that age went off of that ugly old building, those beautiful things. I mean, when the sun would hit that about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that building just absolutely glowed like gold. That's the purpose of the desert experience. The purpose of the desert experience is to sandblast you, to refine you, to remove all of that old filth that has got on you through the years. So you see, he found Israel in a desert. And he protected it like the apple of his eye. Think of the miracles. Think of the manna. He could even say to them, your shoes didn't get worn out, and you always had good clothes. He didn't mean that there was a miracle in the clothes or that the shoes never did wear out. It meant you always had shoes and you always had clothes. It was a miracle of supply. So when he lets you go in the desert, he's still feeding you. He'll teach you to drink or suck honey out of a rock and oil out of a flinty rock. But let me prove it further. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 2. Look what he says here. You shall remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years. Notice, he led thee these 40 years in the wilderness. Why? Number one, to humble you. Number two, to prove you or test you. To know what was in your heart, whether you keep his commandments or not. Number three, he humbled you and suffered you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you knew not, neither did your fathers know, that he may make you know that man does not live by bread alone, or only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. Your raiment waxed not old upon you, neither did your foot swell these 40 years. And you'll also consider in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord thy God chastens thee. Therefore, what's that therefore? Therefore. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks, of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of oil and olive and honey, and wherein you shall eat bread with scarceness. You'll not lack anything in it, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you may dig bread. And when you've eaten and are full, then you'll bless the Lord thy God for the good of the land which he's given thee. And then he tells them, beware, once you get that way, that you don't forget God. See, God says, the reason I put you on the backside of the desert, it humbles you. You won't be humbled just to have your wife divorce you. I remember a woman said to me one time, George, did you change your underwear? That's humbling. To have someone say something like that to you. People automatically imagine that you did something wrong. See, it humbles you. He says it's not only to humble, it's to test you, it's to prove you, to find out whether you'll be obedient or not. I mean, anybody can praise God when things are sunny. But how about when the storms come? When the storms of life come? And you're tested. Who wants metal that's not been tested or tempered? Who wants gold that's not been tried by fire? Who wants silver that's not had the dross removed? Who wants to fight in battle next to a man that's never been to boot camp? God lets us go through trials to test us. And not only humble us and test us, he wants us to know that you don't live by bread alone. It's what I said to that girl. Things don't matter. People do. Before, you scratch on my car, I scratch at your face. You remember seeing that on bumper stickers? You scratch my car before my divorce, I'd been mighty upset. You scratch my car now, no big deal. It's just a car. It's to teach you. You live by what comes out of the mouth of the Lord. It makes you appreciate that he's able to take bad and make it good. And sometimes he says it's chastening. If you're a Christian and you're a child of God, the Bible says he chastens every son that he receiveth. In fact, he says, if you don't receive chastening, then are you illegitimate and not sons? What father is it that doesn't chasten his son? So God allows hard times. And when the people begin to complain and say, poor me, and you begin to feel sorry for yourself, you're in a dangerous position. When you start murmuring, God swore in his wrath, they shall not enter into my rest because they murmured and complained. And I'm wanting to impress upon you tonight that God lets his people go through wilderness experiences because he does that with a purpose. And every Christian's got to go through that. Then thirdly, I want you to notice something else. He tried it. his way and failed. So God spent 40 years now teaching him to humble himself and learning to do it his way. And he gave him his BD degree. He may have had a PhD from the University of Thebes, but God wanted to give him a backside of the desert degree before he says, now, I want you to lead my people. And so thirdly, we're going to watch that God used Moses to do it his way. Now, he's going to spend 40 years seeing what God can do with a nobody. See, Moses made some mistakes. First of all, his timing was off. God had promised Abraham that his seed would be persecuted for 400 years. The 400 years was not up. It had only been 360 years. He was rushing God. His timing was off. He ran ahead of God. Not only was his timing off, his thinking was off. I love it. When he was 40, he said to God, "Don't you see? Don't you hear the affliction of your people?" And God never said a word. And when God did speak to Moses, the first thing out of God's mouth was, "I see, I see, I hear, I hear." 40 years, God didn't answer him. But at the end of the 40 years, God remembered him saying, "Don't you see? Don't you hear?" And God says, "I see, I hear." You may not think God sees, and you don't think God's hearing, but I'm telling you, you may be running ahead of God. You're not on schedule with God. His timing was off. His thinking was off. He doesn't think God cares. Peter says in the ship, "Lord, don't you care that we're perishing?" But when he wrote his epistle, what did he write? "Cast all your cares upon him, for he careth for you." God does care. Don't blame God about timing. He knows the end from the beginning. And don't think he doesn't see, and don't think he doesn't hear. He'll do it in his time, and he does care, and he does see. And not only was his timing off and his thinking off, his technique was off. He supposed that his brethren would understood that by his hand he'd deliver Israel. How? One at a time. He killed one little bitty Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Thought he got away with it. But someone saw him. But now when God does it, is it one little bitty Egyptian hid in the sand? Oh no. God's technique's a lot different than Moses'. He had Moses lift up his hands there by the Red Sea, and he said, "Stand back and watch the salvation of the Lord." And the waters returned over the whole armies of Egypt, and their little bloated bodies floated to the top of the water. And on the seashore, laying on the sand, a whole army. One at a time, Moses? Is that the way you do it? No, the whole army. Drown them all and lay them right out on the sand. No need to bury them. I mean, the difference between the way Moses does a thing and the way God does a thing is the difference between a pea shooter and a cannon. And so's yours. You're using a pea shooter. God will use a cannon. You've got to wait on the Lord. The psalmist says, "Before I went astray," he said, "I went astray until he was sick." But then he said, "He returned." God sometimes lays us flat on our back because the only way we can look is up. 40 years doing it his way. 40 years learning to do it God's way. And in 40 years doing it God's way. Leading the children of Israel. Now Now, I don't want to leave the subject until I quote you 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all of our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. He comforts us in our tribulation. Why? So that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. I'm divorced, and I don't say it boastfully, but I don't know anybody among us that preaches on divorce and invited to speak at marriage seminars more than me. I'm divorced. People actually have me in for sweetheart banquets. Can you imagine anything more stupid than having a divorced man to come in and speak at sweetheart banquets? Why do they have me speak so much on family? Because I comfort with the comfort wherewith I was comforted of God. I can talk to divorced people. I've been there. I know the pain. I know the humility and the humbling that that does to you. And I can minister perhaps better than someone who has not been through the divorce. You comfort through. 6 times now, people have called me up and said, Brother Fall, I had someone in my church that ran over and killed somebody. Could you call them and talk to them? I just had one 3 weeks ago. And I call up and I comfort with the comfort that I myself was comforted of God. When someone has a miscarriage, I can comfort. If someone has a stillborn, I can comfort. I'm trying to tell you that why God allows us to go through things is so that we can comfort with the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. That's why those things are allowed to happen. And you can say like Moses, stand back and watch the salvation of the Lord. I want to tell you 2 stories and then I'll quit. One of them I got from Don DeWelt. He told me this. It's just a story. It's not true. Around the turn of the 1900s, a man was a preacher and he had a son that he wanted to be a preacher. The boy was sharp. And the boy died. Oh, the preacher was brokenhearted. He only stayed in the ministry as a source of income. One day he was sitting rocking in his rocking chair. The curtains blew open on that summer night, and an angel floated right through the window. And he said to the preacher, I'm an angel of mercy on missions of mercy. Do you want to go with me? Yeah. So he went out with the angel, and they watched as an old doctor come running out of the house with his satchel and hop into his horse and buggy. And the angel grabbed the preacher and pulled him and threw a tarp over him so that the old doc couldn't see him. And they went down the road, and unseen by the doctor, the angel reached up and grabbed a hold of the reins of the horse and pulled it too close to the edge. And the horse and buggy went over the hill, and the angel snatched up the preacher, and the old doctor broke his neck. And he said, why? You killed that doctor. You're not an angel of mercy. I am an angel of mercy. Come on. They went over to a farmhouse, and the man and woman was in there just arguing violently. And the woman snatched up a little baby that was on the floor and went over and threw it in its crib, threw a blanket over it. The angel crawled through the window and reached and took the blanket and turned it. No matter which way the little baby rolled, it'd suffocate him. And the baby died. What? Well, you're no angel of mercy. You killed that little baby. I am an angel of mercy. Come on. There was a boy cutting across the ridge down in the mountains on his way to see his girlfriend, and the angel reached and grabbed a rock and pulled it right out from under him. And the kid fell headlong and broke his neck. Preacher couldn't take it anymore. I know who you are. You're the one that took my son. And he began to wrestle him like Jacob of old with the angel. And the angel pinned him down. And the man said, "You're no angel of mercy." And he said, "I am an angel of mercy on missions of mercy." "Then why did you kill that old doctor?" That old doctor lived alone. Wife had been long gone. He had a terrible, inoperable cancer. He was going to die a horrible, painful death. And after all the good he did in mercy, I took his life. "Well, that little baby didn't have cancer." "No, but you saw the parents arguing. Neither one of them wanted it. He was going to end up in an orphanage where they abused children. And in mercy, I took his life." "Well, how about that boy cutting across those things that you killed?" He said, "That boy was headed for sin. And his parents, it would have been more than they could have borne. And in mercy to his parents, I took his life." What do you know? You don't know why God does what he does. You don't know what God's doing behind the scenes. And if we could see behind the scenes what God's doing, we wouldn't murmur so much. If we would see that God is working, we wouldn't complain. We wouldn't murmur. We'd say, "I'm going to learn from this. I'm going to be humbled by this. I realize that he's guarding me as the apple or the pupil of his eye. He's protecting me. He's feeding me. He told Moses, 'You're going to worship me on this mountain.' And he did. I tell you, I've worshiped God on the mountain of divorce. I've worshiped God on the mountain of killing that girl. I've worshiped God for the loss of my son, and I've worshiped God for the loss of my grandchildren. Because I can turn that into a blessing. So can you. If you're not like Israel, and you harden your heart so that God has to swear in his wrath, they're not going to enter into my rest." The last story is the story of a shipwreck. Three or four guys escaped drowning. But the boat just kind of teetered there in the water. And they were good swimmers, and they would swim back, and they got pots and pans and guns and ammunition and everything off the ship that was just almost ready to go on the rest of the way down. Some of it was sticking up out of the water. And they lived on the island for 2 or 3 months, able to sustain themselves from what they were able to take off the ship. But a little plague kind of went through there and killed all of them but one. They'd helped him build a hut. He was there on the island by himself. He was able to get game there on the island, but got so he had to get farther and farther away from his campsite. More often now, he would come home without any game to eat, and he was really beginning to be concerned. One day he was coming back. He looked ahead. He saw smoke. He began to run through the sand dunes. And he got up on the top of the sand dune and looked down, and everything he owned was destroyed and burned up. And he just collapsed in the sand and wept and finally fell asleep. But he was awakened by voices. He saw a big ship offshore and a little rowboat rowing over. And he ran down to the beach. And the men said, "We don't ever come this way, but we saw your smoke signal." And what he thought was his destruction was his salvation. That may be true of your problem. Might be true of your divorce. Might be true of your unhappy marriage. Might be true of your child gone bad. Might be true of your bad health. You see, what we think is our destruction may be our salvation. Someone asked a silversmith, can you burn silver? Oh yeah, silversmith said, you can burn silver. How do you know when to turn off the heat? Oh, it's simple. Well, how do you know? Well, you just keep that old heat turned up there, and that dross just keeps coming to the top, and you just keep skimming off the dross and throwing it away and removing the dross and throwing it away over and over. Yeah, but when do you know when to turn off the heat? If you can burn the silver, how do you know when to turn it off? Well, you just keep removing the dross. And as long as there's dross, you keep removing it. Yeah, but how do you know when to turn off the heat? Oh, he said, that's simple. When you can see your reflection in the silver, you know it's time to turn off the heat. When's God turn off the heat? When he sees his reflection in you, he knows it's time to turn off the heat. The anger is gone. The bitterness is gone. The frustration is gone. The anger and all that's totally gone. The dross is removed. And when he sees his reflection in you, then he can say, come on in to my rest.